You coming in to heckle? You coming in to heckle?
No, I would never.
You can heckle. I don't mind. You know the rules of the game, though. If you heckle, I can heckle back. And I've got a microphone. We're broadcasting now? Okay, well, nobody's listening anyway. Did you? Okay. Okay, the doors are closing, so we must be starting. So, hello. A session after lunch is always great, isn't it? Everybody going to stay awake? Because it's very exciting stuff, this. All about Office 365 groups and compliance or whatever. Anyway, I'm Tony Redmond. I've been to one of these events before, which is always quite nice. Very interesting to see that it's being broadcast live by Skype, which is very good. To give you a little bit of an introduction, so for years and years and years, I was an executive at Digital, Compaq, and HP, and then I decided to get a life and go and do something better with myself, which is what I did when I retired from HP some time ago. Since then, I've been a company advisor working with small software companies and other large companies, mostly to help them figure out what to do about the cloud, which is kind of interesting. When a software company says, what should we do about the cloud? It's kind of like, well, do you not have products that work in the cloud? Because if you don't, you're going to be dead very soon. It's pretty simple. Are indeed with the larger companies to figure out how they're going to embrace the cloud. I also write about this stuff. I also write about this stuff twice a week for Petri.com. So if you want to go and read my ramblings there, I talk about all sorts of stuff that comes into my mind. I'm fortunate I have a lot of friends, a lot of acquaintances that work inside Microsoft, so I do hear about stuff. And I hear about some of the inside stories and what I can share. I do share. I'm also the lead author of this Office 365 for IT Pros ebook, which is kind of an interesting project. We publish every week, and that tells you the amount of change that's in Office 365. Every week, we find the need to refresh maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, even 6 chapters in the book, just because of stuff that we found out, announcements that Microsoft had made, our new code that they have shipped without telling anybody, which is really interesting, you know, especially if you're in the first release. And last thing I'll say, I'm a content chair for a very exciting conference next month in June in Harlem, just down the road from you or up the road from you, wherever. It's a nice place to go for a conference. We'll have about 1,000 people there. And we've got a whole pile of interesting speakers, including people like Mary Jo Foley and Paul Tharrock coming along to talk about where Office 365 is and where it might be going over the next couple of years. So maybe some of you will come along. Anyway, today we're going to talk about Office 365 groups, which is good. But before we go into the details of compliance, I think it's important to put Office 365 groups into context. So first thing I'm going to ask audience participation, how many of you guys actually use groups inside your company? Okay, so it's not a lot. And of the small number of hands, do you use groups with teams? Okay. It's like, this is not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not like a, oh gee, I drank 2 beers last night. It's not like that. It's okay to admit that you use teams. Right? Even if you use Slack before, it's okay. And anybody use Planner? Planner? No? Okay. Dave uses Planner. Okay. So anyway, I think it's fair to say that groups is at the heart of a lot of what Microsoft is trying to do with Office 365. I mean, certainly if you're using distribution groups or if you use distribution groups in the past, you will have noticed that they're very, very keen for you to migrate all those distribution groups to Office 365. But more importantly, they're trying to use Office 365 groups as a vehicle to get people to really exploit all of the power of the service. One of the things about Office 365 is that it's about 6 years old now. And when they first shipped it in June 2011, it really wasn't a cloud platform at all. Instead, Office 365 was a collection of on-premises applications, three of them, Exchange, SharePoint, and Skype, with a little bit of cloud magic and a lot of bandages put up there for people to buy. Over the last 6 years, we've seen enormous progress that Microsoft has made to make things much more cloud aware, much more able to deal with the unique pressures of dealing with the cloud. And while they've made that progress, I still think that some customers are living in the on-premises world. They're mildly cloudified. You know, they do Exchange and that's fine, or they do SharePoint and that's fine, but they don't ever think about what they can do from Office 365 as a whole. And Office 365 Groups actually brings that to people because it does allow them to use many different parts of Office 365 very seamlessly. So that, I see a lot of value in that. I like what Microsoft is doing in this space. So if we're going to talk about compliance, we have to know what we might need to comply or bring under compliance. So there's a lot of stuff that gets involved here. Clearly, an Office 365 group is going to have a number of pieces of data that we need to be aware of. I mean, it starts off with an AAD object, and then you've got an Exchange mailbox. Some people believe that the only thing that's used in the mailbox are the inbox and the calendar, but no, that's not true. There's also the sent items folder where clients leave copies of messages that they have transmitted to as conversations. And recently they added this one here, this conversation history / team chat folder, which is a hidden folder that stores contributions that people make to channels, Teams channels, right? Each team has got a group. Each group has got a mailbox. Each team has got channels. If you contribute to one of those channels, you chat in a channel. Well, the stuff is captured and it's stored in the group mailbox, right? And then we got SharePoint Online, where we've got a complete team site. It's a modern team site, so it's using all of the modern paradigm that Microsoft has set out for that team site. And apart from the documents that are going to be there, we are going to have a shared notebook. And then there's all of these integrations that might be in place. You know, Power BI uses it, Dynamics, that should be Dynamics 365 now, because of course that's the new name, various connectors, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot going on here. So when we talk about compliance, we've got to start off by saying, well, how's Office 365 groups, how are Office 365 groups used in an organization? How do people generate data that we may want to be able to regulate? Or capture, or keep, or retain, whatever. We also need to know about these type of things. So an Office 365 group has a membership. Microsoft is positioning Office 365 groups as an identity and membership service, even as a security service. I'm not so sure about this because there's a lack of granularity here. Basically, you have owners and you have members. And then you have subscribers, but subscribers are really members who have decided to get updates from the group via email. That's all they are. So I don't think it's much of an identity service, apart from the fact that it does, by joining a group, you automatically get all of the access to all of the resources belonging to that group, which is pretty cool when you think about it, because in the past, if you had to go and connect together a user to all of the different things that they might want to access to do some work, that could be pretty painful with all those access control lists and various other kind of gyrations that you have to go through. So it's pretty good that they can do that. So we have a set of group members, owners, members and subscribers. A basic principle that all group members, which belongs to the tenant, because there are other guest members, we'll talk about them in a little while, they share a common level of access to all of the group resources. Groups can be private or public, and they can be hidden as well. There's some work going on to make the hidden aspect a little bit more hidden. Today you can hide groups from the GAL, but there are other aspects of hiding that you might want. For example, inside the educational sector, sometimes you don't want people who are actually in a class to know who are the other members in that class. You know, there are various regulations around the world that encourages this type of privacy. So Microsoft is doing some work in that space. Some basic points too. What does it mean for you when you come to approach them? First thing is that if you come from an on-prem environment, forget all that stuff. This stuff is never going to go into on-prem. Right? Even in a hybrid space, what gets replicated back, what gets synchronized back to the on-prem world is really just a very poor representation of a group because it's a distribution group. Looks, feels, behaves, right? So these are cloud-only objects. They only exist in the cloud. They will only ever exist in the cloud. You don't manage them like Exchange. You don't manage them like SharePoint. You manage them in their own right. You manage them with the tools that are available for Office 365 groups, okay? Microsoft has started to use groups as a membership and identity service, as we said earlier. It's gradually spreading. You know, Planner was the first application to pick up the service. Now we have Teams introduced in last November, 2nd of November, 2016. Staff Hub, which is introduced a little bit later on. I'm not sure that anybody here used Staff Hub. It's a pretty American application for things like people who work for McDonald's. You know, but that kind of thing, you know, type of hourly paid shift workers, that kind of thing. But it's an interesting example of how you can take an infrastructure, a fabric that's been built up and expand it into a new application that you would probably never think of Microsoft developing, but that's what they did. We also have this thing of Yammer groups. Yammer in the past had its own way of representing group membership, etc. Well, Yammer is now picking up Office 365 groups as its method of holding membership. So we'll have two classes of Office 365 groups. We'll have Outlook groups and Yammer groups. Both of them will have access to both of them have access to SharePoint. So they have complete access to the group library. The only difference is that where they store their conversations. If you're an Outlook group, the conversations are stored in Exchange. That's important because if you're a Yammer group, the conversations are stored in Yammer. And why is that important? Well, from a compliance perspective, we have to understand that Yammer is probably the weakest part of Office 365 when it comes to compliance. Retention policies don't apply to Yammer. You can't put holds on Yammer content. You can't put classification labels on Yammer content. So it's really, really, really important to understand that. That is currently rolling out, okay? And of course, SharePoint team sites now use Office 365 groups as their membership. So there's a lot going on here. Right? And it's important to understand that when you come to thinking about how you're going to manage it. There are some limitations. So I'll just pull those up. Nothing really important to stay here apart from this one. Okay. Actually, the top one is important. If you create groups centrally, if you have, for example, an admin account, who creates them, you should immediately after creation, you should assign the ownership of the group to another account so you don't hit this limit, you know, where you have an admin account who's the owner of 250 groups and then it goes wallop. You can't do that, okay? The reason why this is a problem could be if you've got very, very large groups and they all try and get to the group calendar at the same time. It's not really a good thing. It's going to be slow. That's the kind of problem we have there. Again, an overview. There are a wide variety of clients that are available. Mac is the new one. It's just rolling out. Mac version Office was it Outlook 2016 version 15.26 or above for all the Mac fans in the audience. Another interesting one is that the Outlook Groups mobile app is going to be transitioned into Outlook for iOS and Outlook for Android. So the whole idea there is that you have a single app that can get to all of this kind of conversation type of information. So you got email, that's a kind of conversation. Well, the conversations that are in groups are also a kind of conversation. And it makes sense. I actually think it would be very smart for Microsoft to go and look at the wide range of apps they have for Office 365. I have 20 of them installed on my iPhone right now. That's probably 10 too many. Some rationalization needs to happen. They need to bring those groups, those apps together. And that is probably the first sign. Okay, now that we know all about groups, we can talk about compliance. We can figure out what we need to talk about. And in this section, I talk a little bit about creation, because that's a form of compliance in itself. Clearly, if you don't control creation, you could have a lot more places where you have to go and look for data, right? Then we'll talk about the compliance features that exist inside Office 365 and how they apply to Office 365 groups. And then finally, I want to talk about backup. And you may say, why do we want to talk about backup? Well, a lot of organizations believe in backup as a way to ensure compliance. Things like having an off-site backup of all of their data gives them a warm feeling in their bellies that if something bad happens, they're going to be able to restore everything. So we'll talk about that. Okay, creating new groups. Out of the box, you create a new tenant. Everybody's happy. Why are they happy? Because they can all create new Office 365 groups. Now, in November 2014, a group of us met with the Microsoft engineers in Redmond, and we had a big fight because they gave us this news. They said, great, Office 365 groups, fantastic. It's going to be so collaborative. Anybody can create a new group. After we picked ourselves up off the floor, we said, are you guys, insert bad word here, bad word here, bad word here, mad? Because we've seen this picture before. Anybody who ever dealt with public folders, right? Now, you make that mistake once and you see what happens. And there are some organizations in Europe that are still coping with that 20 years later on. There's one in particular that's got 20 terabytes of data in public folders spread over 500,000 public folders. Now, you're looking at each other and say, that's not me, is it? Have I looked recently, right? But seriously, why did this happen? Well, exactly the same thing happened in 1996 when Microsoft said, we've got the best collaborative thing you could ever get, and that's public folders. And everybody can create a public folder and share. And so they did. And then public folders took root, and they're like weeds. You can't get rid of them, right? So one of the things I say to organizations that are concerned about compliance is, look, first thing you're going to do is you're going to place some control. Because if you don't place control now, it's going to be impossible in 2 years' time to gain control. So, unfortunately, we have two policies that control creation. One is the OWA mailbox policy. That was the original one introduced when OWA was the only client, and it's still there today. Why? Don't know. But they have a new one, which is the Azure AD policy. It's a directory settings object that contains a whole set of settings. One of those settings is a group. And that group, whoever is a member of that group, is able to create groups. Okay? So my recommendation is to any organization that wants to talk about compliance is you get control of groups first, because otherwise you're going to have a really bad time. Okay? It's not this problem. This is an issue that people talk about. Oh, if you create lots of groups, it's going to take up so many resources. That doesn't matter, because Microsoft is paying for all the resources. And they have huge amounts of disk space. They don't care. You don't care about how many groups you have from a resource point of view. There are two things you care about. One is possibly pollution in your GAL. You know, if you have your GAL is full of Sally's group for flower arrangers and other various groups that might not have a business purpose, right? I mean, beer lovers of the world unite, and I think that would probably be a good group to have, but, you know, So that gal pollution is one problem. But the bigger problem is that if you allow these groups to proliferate, you will then have more and more places to control later on. So from a compliance perspective, I say to you, take control now. So what compliance issues might exist? Well, it's the same compliance issues that exist for all of Office 365. When you think about it, groups are no different. They're just a way of storing data. The reason why they're going to accumulate data is that users like to interact using groups. It's no more or no less than that. In the past, they might have used other applications. I mean, way, way, way back in the past, Digital Equipment Corporation had a thing called Notes, Vax Notes. And at one stage, there were 8,000 or 9,000 conferences, as they were called at that stage, supporting 160,000 users. That's technology that goes back into the 1970s. So there's nothing here that's really unusual about providing people ways to communicate. What's unusual now is the fact that the society we live in has become a lot more sensitive about how data is used and how data is protected and how data might be abused, right? So that's what we need to worry about. So in terms of compliance across Office 365, we want to make sure that company data is properly used. We want to make sure that we comply with any regulations that apply to our industry. You know, in the US, if you're in the finance industry, then SEC 17A-4, that regulation is really, really important for trading, right? But we also need to take account of legal requirements, and every country is different. Okay, today we talked about some of the stuff the European Union is trying to regularize and rationalize data protection for personal information and so on. But, you know, an international company will operate inside the EU, outside the EU, and they'll probably have multiple regulations to deal with. All of that. But then, I guess, when you hear Microsoft talking about its new data governance framework for Office 365, which I think is quite good, they emphasize 2 points. And it really boils things down quite nicely. They say, you want to keep data that's needed, right? That's fair. But you also want to get rid of a lot of data. So you get rid of the data that you don't need. Why do you not need it? Well, who needs a 10-year-old email? You know, you might need it if it was an important business record, but if it's from your Auntie Maud telling you about some jam that she's just made for you, probably we can get rid of that. So I think that crystallizes, those two sentences crystallize what we need to do. We need to keep what we need, and we need to get rid of what we don't. Pretty simple. Now, how do we do that with Office 365? Well, talk about what we might need to keep and what we might need to get rid of. So here's a list, fairly basic list. We've got the conversations. Yep. People are going to have a conversation. They're going to email each other basically into this group mailbox, and all of those contributions are going to be kept in threaded conversations. And all of that stuff is stored in the group mailbox, in the inbox folder. So that's pretty easy stuff. Group calendar, yeah, probably want to have a record of any group meetings that were set up. That's okay, that's in the calendar folder of the group mailbox. Pretty simple stuff. The shared notebook, yeah, if people use OneNote to collaborate and share stuff, we'd like to know about that. Where's that? It's in the document library, so that's fine. Any files that are collaboratively created, we'd like to know about those. Those are all stored in the document library, so that's okay. We know about those. The team chats, where are they kept? Well, in fact, there are two places they're kept. We already talked a little bit about contributions to channels, which end up in the group mailbox owning the team. But if you and I have what they call a one-to-one chat, or we have a group chat. They use groups too many places inside Microsoft. A group chat is a chat inside Teams that involves multiple people. Anyway, if you have one of those type of chats, then records are kept in your personal mailbox. So everybody who's involved in that chat, an entry for each contribution made. So I say, hi, we capture that and we put it as an item in the conversation histories / Teams chats folder of your mailbox and my mailbox, because we're the two participants, right? You respond, say, hi, it's another contribution. We take that and we keep it. You can see that there could be a lot of items captured for people that are very chatty, but that's pretty well one of the only ways they can do it. Can users see this folder? No. It's in conversation history, and they can certainly see conversation history because that's the one that's used to store records of Skype IM conversations, but it's a hidden folder and it's not revealed by any clients. However, it is indexed, so it's discoverable, which is the whole point. So that's okay. We know we can take care of that. Now, Planner. Planner is all about tasks. You know, set of projects and inside the inside plan, sorry, they have all these tasks. Some of that data is recorded because, you know, there are notifications that go out to plan members. They go out by email, so they're going to be captured. That's fine. If people create documents as part of a plan, they're going to be captured because they go here into the group document library. That's fine. What isn't captured is metadata. Metadata about the plan items, such as who is assigned a task, what was the end date of the task, was there any description about that task. That information is not yet available for compliance purposes. So that's a bit of a gap. You could also say in Teams that there is a gap about things like team channel descriptions and stuff like that, or settings. They're not available for compliance purposes either. And then finally, Staff Hub. Staff Hub, there's an awful lot of Staff Hub which is not captured for compliance purposes yet. The reason why, what's shared here about these three applications is that the three of them use Azure Data Services, where they have their own data stores. And those data stores are invisible from Office 365 compliance. Okay, so basic rules for compliance. You're not going to go near the individual workloads for compliance for these groups. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, remember I said in June 2011 when Office 365 was launched, we had these individual applications all stitched together and cloudified, and there was Office 365. It's true. And each one of those applications had some compliance features. If you looked at Exchange Online as it was then, it was built atop of Exchange 2010. So the compliance features that were in Exchange 2010 went forward into Exchange Online. If you look at SharePoint, it was the same thing. The compliance features that were available in SharePoint were taken forward. In 2013, Microsoft refreshed Office 365. And so the compliance features were refreshed because there were new on-premises versions. And that's where we got things like the SharePoint e-discovery center, deletion policies, preservation policies, and so forth. The big difference now is that over the last 2 years, Microsoft has invested an enormous amount of engineering effort in building compliance features that work across all of Office 365. The idea is that you should be able to create a single policy and apply it everywhere. So for that reason, from July 1, 2017, which is not that far away, you will no longer be able to create things like new e-discovery searches and holds with Exchange Online, or e-discovery cases with SharePoint Online. However, any holds that exist, any searches that exist that were created before that time can still be processed. And there's a very good reason for this, and that is because compliance cases tend to last for a very long time. There are some compliance cases that have lasted 10 or longer years, 10 or more years, okay? So the basic thing is what I'm saying to you is that look to the Office 365 Security and Compliance Center. That's where you're going to do your work with Office 365 groups. You're not going to go near Exchange Online. You're not going to go near SharePoint Online. Forget about them. They're dead. They're gone. I'm not saying the SharePoint is gone. Don't anybody tweet that. I get into such trouble if something. No. It's just the compliance bits are being replaced in Office 365. You guys understand that? Please tweet. Please don't. Okay. All right. So, what can you do? Well, there's lots you can do. SCC is the Security and Compliance Center, right? And there's a whole pile of new functionality there for you. So start off, basic thing is a content search. What's a content search? It's like an Exchange eDiscovery search, except it's on much, 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 much better. One of the problems that the on-premises products have always had is that they're designed to work inside a single server. Okay? So if you do a search, let's say, when Exchange 2016, you do that search on that 2016 server. Now, if there are mailboxes on other Exchange servers in your organization, the server that starts the search says to those servers, have you got any information that might match what I need? And it will then gather all that information together, and it will then provide you with the results. However, the problem here is, you've got a single point of failure and you've got a choke point. That's the server that's running the search. What happened, and it's the same type of thing, by the way, in SharePoint, SharePoint on-prem. What happens inside Office 365 is that we have a fabric of servers. Now, fabric is just thousands and thousands and thousands of servers knitted together. That's a fabric. So when Office 365 needs to do a content search, it can use a single server as the search coordinator, but then it basically just spreads the search out across all available servers that it can get hold of, and then assembles the results asynchronously and brings them all back together. The effect of this is that searches are faster and they're much, much more scalable. With Exchange 2016, you can include, I think, a maximum of 10,000 mailboxes in a single search. With a content search, you can include, they say unlimited. I asked them then, well, what's the biggest search you've ever done? Oh, 550,000 mailboxes, a single search. How many items did that return? Ooh, 173 million kind of thing. So you can get the idea that the kind of searches that are built into Office 365 are much more scalable, much more powerful than what we had in the on-premises world. And that's simply because they're using the power of the cloud and all those server resources that are available to them, right? Content searches are very good because they can search mailboxes, shared mailboxes, group mailboxes, user mailboxes. They can search SharePoint. They can search OneDrive for business sites and Exchange public folders in the same search. The only problem I ever have with these searches is the query language it uses, KQL query language, which is used to construct the keyword queries that you put into the search. It takes a little bit of time to get to know them, know how to use these words, especially because Exchange doesn't support some keywords and SharePoint doesn't support other keywords. But we'll get back to that in a moment. But essentially, this is where you're going to search group mailboxes. And it will find all that Teams data as well, by the way, because, of course, that Teams data, the chat data, is indexed and discoverable and available to you, right? So that's content searches. Next one. With Exchange, you have mailbox retention policies. Yeah, everybody knows about them. So Office 365 retention policies are a little bit different. They're not as granular as Exchange. And that's because they have to apply across all types of Office 365 data. SharePoint, for example, doesn't, our OneDrive, our Link don't, or sorry, Skype, don't have archive folders. So there's no notion of archive in the same way as you have with Exchange, where you can say, you know, after a message is 10 days old, archive it. Can't do that. Instead, what we've got is the ability to set up some pretty powerful policies which allow you to say, yep, I want to keep this information, or I want to remove this information. That comes back to the original thought, right? How am I going to identify it? Well, I can identify it on an age basis. For example, keep this information for 5 years. And then what do I do? Well, delete it or leave it alone. Or delete anything that's over 10 years old. Or, and this is where it gets really interesting, only apply this retention to specific items that are identified by a query. Or only if only apply this to specific items of a certain sensitive data type, such as, you know, find me all messages on in the tenant that contain credit card numbers, keep them for 20 years, that kind of thing. So they're very powerful. And again, they apply to Exchange mailboxes, including the group mailboxes, SharePoint, OneDrive, and Skype. They will apply not to Skype voice conversations, but they will apply to Skype IM conversations. This is due to be expanded into other workloads over the next couple of years. Okay. The nice thing about it, they also put holds on the information that they have to keep. So if you say, I want to keep information for 5 years, an in-place hold is automatically placed on that content, no matter where it is inside Office 365. So this is pretty powerful stuff. Now, I already said that SharePoint and Exchange don't support the same keyword queries. How do we get past that? Well, there's this concept of e-discovery cases. This came from SharePoint. SharePoint always had an e-discovery center, and in the e-discovery center, you had cases, and cases had different components. And that's exactly what these e-discovery cases are. It allows you to combine a number of holds, a number of searches, a number of export operations. Because in complex e-discovery investigations, it's likely that you're going to have a number of people who are investigating. You're going to have a number of different areas that you want to look at, and you may have different queries. For example, you might have one query which is about stuff that happened in 2015. That's one specific query for one specific set of people. And then there's another set of people, because management roles changed, who now do those roles in 2017. So you have a different query for those folks. And then you might have a third query, which is specifically for documents, that leverages some of the document-specific keyword syntax that's supported, right? And the great thing about an e-discovery case is that you can manage the whole thing as a whole. So at the end of the day, when you have found the right information, you can then bring it together and assemble it in one place, and either export all that information to, so in a form that's available for external investigators, you know, like professional e-discovery forensic people, or you can pump it into the advanced e-discovery functionality that's available in Office 365 E5 plan. So that's pretty good. And again, group mailboxes and the document libraries, they can all be covered by this. So you get this feeling that, you know, there's actually quite a lot of compliance stuff here, and it's all relatively recently developed, and it's all been it's all available through the Security and Compliance Center, right? So last two, classification labels. What are they? Well, this is a concept that came from SharePoint. SharePoint allows you to put a classification label on something. But these are classification labels that can actually do something. You can still create classification labels that have no action. But on the other hand, you can create classification labels that have a very specific meaning. For example, if I create a classification label saying keep for archive or keep for audit, let's say, right, and I want to stamp that on financial records, I can actually go and say any item that this label is applied to is going to be kept for 10 years. So there is a retention action associated with the label. And those labels can be applied again to Exchange, to SharePoint, to OneDrive, or in this case, if you are the owner of a group, you can apply it to a group conversation. All right. Now, the one bad thing about classification labels, I'll tell you, is that, and it's not a bad thing, but it's a thing to be careful about, is that you can mark a classification label as being a record, a formal record. Now, when you mark something as a formal record, you say, this is never, ever, ever going to be interfered with again. And by interfered with means somebody can't remove that label. Right? It stays there. And if the retention action on that label says keep forever, that's what Office 365 is going to do. It's going to keep it. It's a little thing to bear in mind. In terms of DLP, there are two types of DLP policies inside Office 365. There's the exchange ones, which are imposed by transport rules. Yeah, everybody knows that. And then they're what they call the unified DLP policies, which are not imposed by transport rules. Instead, they're imposed by background processes that are loosely coupled in most respects to the content indexing. You know, as items are added to an Exchange mailbox, or as a new SharePoint document is added to a document library, it's automatically indexed by the Search Foundation. So there are components running inside the indexing processes that will then check for DLP violations. Again, you can apply these DLP policies to group mailboxes and to the group document libraries. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. There's a lot of possibility. And as I said earlier, a lot of this, if I'd been talking to you in January, you wouldn't see the retention policies and you wouldn't see the classification labels. And DLP was still in motion. The e-discovery cases didn't work as well as they do now. There's a lot of stuff that's been added in the last 4 months, and it's all really good. Okay, now back to backup. Old timer stuff. Everybody loves a backup, right? Warm backup gives you a warm feeling until you drop it, right? Or spill a Coca-Cola on your tape or whatever. Anyway, just in general about Office 365 groups, when we look at the various places, we have to realize that basically Microsoft doesn't take backups except for SharePoint. Okay, Exchange Online, no backups. It's all about native data protection. And that means that anything that's stored in a group mailbox, like those conversations, those team chats, they are protected by native data protection. Multiple copies, one of which is a lagged copy, single item retention, all that good stuff. That's how that's protected. In terms of group document libraries, they're backed up along with other SharePoint online data. The recycle bin works. If you do go and blow something away, or you forget, let's put it like that, you forget to recover a document that's in a document library that was deleted, so you forget to go to the recycle bin and get it back, you can ask Microsoft to restore the site collection. This is not a good thing to do because it's a complete restore of the site collection. It's not an individual restore of a certain document. So it's not something that you really want to do, okay? Data associated with some of those integrated apps like Planner, not backed up. All that metadata I talked about before in Azure Data Services, not backed up. Biggest problem I think we've got right now is that if you decide, if your managers or your, you know, those in power say that you've got to have backups, I've got to have backups, I can't go into Office 365 unless I have backups. The vast majority of the products that are out there today that say they're Office 365 backups. Yeah, what they are is mildly changed versions of the products that worked for on-prem. So they understand Exchange, great. They'll understand SharePoint. They will not understand groups. Specifically, what they will not understand is how to reassemble a group together again if you need to restore it. I mean, you can back up the contents of a group document library, fine. You can back up the contents of a group mailbox, fine. Now, let's say everything goes belly up. Can you restore it back together again so that it functions the same way for users? No, backup products don't work like that. The only one I've seen so far is the AvPoint DocAv product. That does it. But it only does it for partial. It only does it for the conversations. So that's a thing to be aware of. Okay, in terms of SharePoint, I just want to mention very quickly that the transition that was going on inside Office 365 to modern team sites is now complete. So basically, all the team sites that are out there should have association groups, which is fine. But if your business need dictates that you don't want to have a group association with a team site, you still do not, you can still create what they call classic team sites. So you're not forced to use groups. Why might this be important in a compliance sense? Well, recall back what we said, that everybody in a group has got the same level of access to a group. So therefore, if you have a group that's got some really sensitive documents into it, in it, you may not want every group member to be able to delete or even edit all of the documents that are in the group. So if you want the kind of granularity of permissions to protect information, you may find that a classic team site is a better option for you. Okay, so that's why I wanted to make that point to you guys. Now, groups were the first Office 365 application, apart from SharePoint, to come up with the ability to support guest users. And it is built on top of the SharePoint guest user scenario. The whole idea is that you should be able to allow people outside of your tenant, be they other Office 365 users or people, you know, your lawyers, your financial advisors, whatever, to be able to get access to a group. And that's fine. You can do that by granting access to that person's email address. They will receive an invitation to join the group. If they take the invitation and they have a Microsoft account, they will be able to get in and access the group. But they can only access the documents in the group. Why? Because this is built on top of the SharePoint sharing mechanism. Is this an issue for us for our compliance? Well, yes, it could be, because you know, you now have external users coming in to access what could be confidential information. So I think before you turn on group access, you have to figure out, is this a good thing for you? And you also have to figure out what mechanisms exist to deal with some of the challenges that come out. For example, is everybody going to be able to extend an invitation? Let's say I set up a group for, and I call it awfully sensitive financial information group. And I put all sorts of company planning documents in there. And then I send an invitation, because I'm the owner of the group. I can send an invitation. I send an invitation to joesoap@mycompetitor.com. Because I'm a really sneaky guy, and I'm looking for a job with mycompetitor.com. I've just sent out that invitation. Has your organization got the controls in place to make sure that those type of sharing invitations are detected and reviewed and revoked if necessary? There's no concept of a blacklist or a whitelist here. Those invitations just go. And somebody can then come in and say, oh yeah, thank you, Joe Soap at Microsoft, at mycompetitor.com could come in, and they have full access to that document library. So that might be an issue. Right. You might also think about, I don't need to talk about this too much. Okay, these are the access controls. But so this is what I was saying. Group owners can invite external people to be group users, and group members can request access. So that's how those invitations are going out. External access is not yet there for Planner and Teams. Microsoft has committed that Teams will have external access by the middle of the year, which we're very rapidly approaching. So that'll be there, and that could be another issue. Now, as I said, here's some of the restrictions that are in place. Right. So the person coming in, they can access cloudy attachments if those cloudy attachments are stored in the group document library. Why? Because they have access to them. Okay. They can't see the full GAL. I mean, you don't want somebody coming in to be able to go and peruse your organizational structure. So that's blocked. They can't access conversations. Why? Because they're in the Exchange mailbox or the Yammer data store. So they're blocked because we're using SharePoint permissions. All right. They see a restricted view of group users. What does that mean? Well, if you go and have a look at the properties of a group user, normally, if you're a member of the tenant, you will see things like your title, and you'll see things like telephone number, and you'll be able to trace down through the organization. All of that stuff is just restricted. They can't see it. There's no mobile access, so they can't use the Outlook Groups app to get to it. Why? Because, again, we want to channel it all through a browser, so we have much better control. And there's no access from Outlook. Again, we're using SharePoint. As I said, there's no way to specifically block access to a particular user or a particular domain. So you're going to have to check on these sharing invitations, right? There's various ways of doing this. A little bit of PowerShell will do it. Dave will sell you a book to tell you about PowerShell if you want one. Okay. But here's a design issue that I'll put out for you, which you may want to think about when you're designing groups that accommodate group guest access. Do you really want to have guest users seeing everything in a group, or will you create specific groups for those guests? And those groups would have a subset of the documents that would be available to everybody else. I think this is a thing you have to figure in, you have to factor in right now when you're doing the design, rather than coming back later on and say, oh my God, we have so many guest users coming in and they're seeing all this confidential information. That's really hard to deal with. Get the practices done right now. And it's simple. You just say to anybody who wants to have a group that's going to have guest users, say, right, okay, what's in this? What is this group going to discuss? What kind of confidential information is going to be in it? And if the confidential information is above a certain level, and that's up to you to decide, say, well, it looks like we're going to have two groups. One group is going to be available only to internal members, and one will be available to internal members and external members. Sorry, that's the way, that's the only way that we can assure security. Now, just in finishing, I'll have a brief few words about migration. Because we joked a little bit about public folders. Well, there's all that stuff that has no compliance whatsoever in it. Right? I mean, public folders, compliance? Give it. It has some compliance. It has. You can do content searches against it. But it generally doesn't have retention policies and whatnot. So you may have some of these things and you say, I'd like to get them across to Office 365 groups because Office 365 groups has got all this compliance stuff going for it now, and I can really control it much, much better than I can do with the old stuff. So there are some tools out there. It's a challenging kind of situation. If you want to, for example, move public folders, there are various tools. Binary Tree has got E2E Complete. It'll move stuff across. Quadratech is a tool called Atom, which is advanced data analytics for migration or something like that. Basically, both of these will allow you to move public folders across to things like mailboxes or indeed Office 365 groups. And Microsoft is working on their own solution in this space. I hear that it might appear at Ignite, but you know, that's just a rumor. Some guy outside told me, and he had a dog, and I didn't know who the dog was, but he seemed to know who he was talking about. So you can take that as a rumor, right? If you need to move stuff from your personal things let's say you have your personal OneDrive or you have other SharePoint sites, you can use the OneDrive sync client to move them across into Office 365 group. That's quite effective. Just move them on the PC, synchronize the libraries, drag and drop the stuff in on the PC so it goes into the right library and then synchronize and it'll all go up, okay? Outlook doesn't support drag and drop. I don't hear that is coming anytime soon, so sorry about that. I don't think that's going to come. In terms of distribution groups, you can move distribution groups over. The one big caveat is that Exchange distribution groups have got normally have got lots of different types of objects. You know, you've got mail contacts in there. You might have public folders, mail-enabled public folders. shared mailboxes and that kind of stuff. You can move those distribution groups over, but you'll only be able to move the mailbox users from the groups. And the way to do it is that Microsoft has got a number of migration facilities when we, in a moment, I'll be very distracted. Somebody has link going. But you can't move any dynamic groups. Dynamic groups are supported by Office 365 groups, but they cost you extra. Dynamic groups require an Azure AD premium license, okay? Which would be quite expensive, because the way it works is that every single user that comes under the scope of a filter in a dynamic group requires an Azure AD premium license. Now, you may have an Azure AD premium license. If you bought something like Enterprise Mobility and Security, you probably will. But let's say you were in a scenario, say, I need a group for the entire company. So I'll create a dynamic group, and the filter is all mailboxes. And your company is 50,000. Now, suddenly you've got $3 a month for 50,000 people. You just created that licensing problem for yourself, just to let you know.
In hybrid?
Hybrid what? What's the question?
Dynamic groups in a hybrid.
No, I don't believe so. You can't have hybrid groups. Hybrid Office 365 groups, no, I don't believe they work. I have never been able to make them work, but maybe I'm doing something wrong. Okay, in terms of what are the migration facilities for these tools, there are things like one click from the Exchange Admin Center. There are various Microsoft scripts. There's a GitHub project called Hummingbird, and you can create your own PowerShell scripts, or you can just run new unified group. So you can get stuff across, can get all this old stuff across into this new world of compliant Office 365 groups. Okay, in summary, with 2 minutes left, which gives us 2 minutes for questions, there's lots of stuff you can do with Office 365 groups. We talked mostly here about compliance, but clearly they are a really good basis for communication and collaboration. I will leave you with the thought that they're still not perfect. I mean, they're not the perfect answer for everything. So there's still room in the Office 365 space for things like shared mailboxes, distribution groups, and indeed Yammer for large-scale enterprise communication. Okay, so I'll stop there with 2 minutes to go, which gives you 2 minutes for some really good questions. You don't ever have any really good questions. But seeing you're the only one with a hand up, I'm hoping that it'll be a really good question for the first time in your life. That's all right. Mark and I have known each other. We've known each other for 30 years. I'm allowed to say things like that.
Anyway.
And now he's thinking, oh, well, I can't ask that question anyway.
That's okay, because he used to be a vice president.
That's why I stopped being a vice president. I couldn't stand Mark falling asleep. It was embarrassing, you know. I mean, I couldn't go down as a vice president and pour a glass of water over him, you know. Yeah. I can do it now, though. Anyway, go ahead.
Groups.
Yeah, that's what we've been talking about. Have you been listening? You've been asleep, haven't you? There are no tools, correct. That's a very good question. There are no tools available yet to migrate one group from one tenant to another. And it's all, I suspect it's because all about permissions. Now, there are companies working on this, I know, but I'm not sure that anybody's got stuff. But again, you know, with Ignite coming around in September, who knows what new tools are going to be launched on the market. And I think it'd be fair to say that we'll see what people have been working on for the last year or so. But there are no tools today, sir.
Are there any more changes coming along for the where you can use an existing shared mailbox as a group? We have a lot of customers who use
shared mailboxes
as a mean of...
So you
see that the mailbox in the group is not the same as the shared mailbox.
Right. So let me paraphrase that question and ask the question the way I would ask it. Will Microsoft upgrade Office 365 groups so you have the same functionality that exists in shared mailboxes? For example, the ability to have access to all of the folders in the mailbox? Okay, they've heard this request.
They said no.
I didn't say that. You said that. No, they have heard this request. It's come in a lot of many times. Okay. So I guess the question, the way I heard it discussed once was, okay, we got all this stuff, the really, really, really important stuff that needs to be done. You know, I mean, they have already announced that they're working on things like policy-based administration so that after you can put a life cycle on a group, let's say 2 years, if it hasn't been used in 2 years, you're going to get an email to say, hey, do you really need this group or can we delete it? So they're working on a lot of stuff. And what they're saying, I think, is the shared mailboxes already do this. You can keep on using shared mailboxes until we get around to clearing all this backlog of development, and then maybe we'll be able to do that. That's the way I heard it explained to me once. And I thought it was reasonable. I mean, you know, every week you turn around and you look at groups and there's something new in there, right? So, you know, they're working very hard, and there's a big development group working on it. So they are making progress, but it's just going to take time to get around to shared mailboxes because shared mailboxes are already there and do the job. There's all sorts of other things I've heard, like, for example, there's no way to put a category on an email in a group. And people use that all the time. You know, a message comes in from a customer to a shared mailbox and say, this is a category one problem. Flag it with a big red label, that kind of thing. That's kind of important for the scenarios that are used in shared mailboxes. So they have to do all of that work. Yeah.
What controls do you have if you have an Office 365 group with external users or guest users?
Yeah.
And a internal user uploads a document with, for instance, credit card information. Is there any control from the organization to prevent the access to that document?
Okay, so the first thing is, like, can you detect those documents with sensitive data? And yes, you can, because DLP policies will detect them. The next question is, can you stop somebody who has access to the group as a guest member? Can you stop them going anywhere near the document that is flagged because it's got confidential information in it? No, you can't. Remember what I said earlier? Once you're a member of the group, you have full access to everything in the group, including, by the way, the ability to delete stuff. So if you invite a guest user into a group, they can delete all the stuff there. This is why I said that, you know, if you're going to have confidential information, maybe you want to split the group into two.
But you could use some information rights management on the document itself.
You could use information rights management. Yes, you could. Yes, you could.
Yeah,
you could put a template. Yeah, you could put a template on, and basically the way the templates protect information, and unless you have got the ability to get a license to decrypt the content, yes, you could do that. Yeah. And in fact, Microsoft's plan of records. Remember, I talked about classification labels. Okay. So right now we have a surplus of labels inside Office 365, like we have a surplus of groups. You have the AIP labels, the Azure Information Protection labels, and you have classification labels. There is an effort underway inside Microsoft to bring the two together so that one of the actions that you can invoke for a classification label is to protect the content. So in a little while, it might be possible to stamp the document that you want to protect with a confidential label, and that a part of stamping it with a confidential label will be the automatic application of a rights template. Yep. Of course, I didn't know that either. That guy outside with the doc. This has been taped. I'm going to be hung out to dry. It's lucky Microsoft has said this publicly, because otherwise I couldn't say it at all. Okay, I think we're done. We're 5 minutes over. That means that you have 5 minutes less time to drink coffee before the next session, but because it's been given by Michael van Horenbeek, you don't need any coffee because he sends you to sleep anyway. So thank you very much for coming in, and I hope you enjoyed it.